To begin, a session on how to talk so kids will listen and listen so kids will talk. It's based on a book by Adele Faber and Elaine Mazlish. It's been out for a number of years, and I think you'll find it very helpful. It was put out originally in 1980, but it's common sense information. Sometimes, however, I don't think our sense is quite as common or we are as aware of it as we might be. There's a couple things I want to do. One, to give a kind of summary that they have from the book. I have some segments from a videotape that I use from another parenting course that's called Active Parenting by Michael Popkin. He also has a book out on that topic. But there's a couple of sections that relate to our communication skills that can help us focus a little bit more directly on them. What's it all about anyway, Faber and Mazlish say at the end of their book, and this is what they come up with. We want to find a way to live with each other so that we can feel good about ourselves and help the people we love feel good about themselves. We want to find a way to live without blame and recrimination. We want to find a way to be more sensitive to another's feelings. We want to find a way to express our irritation or anger without doing damage. We want to find a way to be respectful to our children's needs and to be just as respectful to our own needs. We want to find a way that makes it possible for our children to be caring and responsible. We want to break the cycle of unhelpful talk that has been handed down from generation to generation and pass on a different legacy to our children. A way of communicating that they can use for the rest of their lives with their friends, their coworkers, their parents, their mates, and one day with children of their own. So that's one of the basic. I understand that from comments I received from a couple people that some were wondering, what were the ages of my children that I talk about now, how to talk so kids will listen and listen so kids will talk. Our two daughters are now almost 25 and almost 28. So they've been basically raised. I did my first training as a parent effectiveness training instructor back in 1970, so that would have been when they were 6 and 9, thereabouts. And I'm trained as a therapist, as a counselor. My background is in child and family studies, and I've taught parent education at Syracuse University and at Conestoga College in Waterloo, Ontario. I think parenting is a very important role. And even though I already had a background in child and family studies before I became a parent and then continued on doing coursework on my master's and toward a doctorate, there's still a lot that you learn by practical experience. There's lots of things, we're talking more about it now with our daughters as they are adults. Our second daughter is to be married next spring. Our first daughter is finishing her doctorate in linguistics and is in Scotland doing her research on her dissertation this summer. I think they're delightful young women. And I used to say we were very, very proud of them, but we were very excited and pleased and enjoyed about how they have managed their lives. They can be proud of what they've done. I like to use the word proud as the one that you ought to own for the things you do rather than you own for someone else. When I begin to say I'm proud of my daughters, that takes ownership of them, that I've done, I've done what for them what has made them as they are. I don't think that's true. I think in spite of me, perhaps, or even along with me, that they have done what they have done on their own. Communication is certainly a very important part of that child-rearing responsibilities. Communication, whether we use it with our partners, whether we use it with our friends, whether we use it with our children. In fact, sometimes we use better communication with our friends than we do with our own children. We would never yell at our friends the way we yell at our kids sometimes. We would never be as exasperated, we probably would feel it, but we wouldn't say it, to our friends or our coworkers as that we might. In fact, sometimes we come home and take out on our kids what belonged in the workplace or out somewhere else, because home is where when you go there, they have to take you in, according to Frost. One of the things I'd like to do first is a brief segment from a videotape from the Active Parenting Program that I think sort of sets the scene. It starts out a bit with a little story on respect and a marvelous little scene showing that respect in action that will help us set the stage. And then we'll go on to a couple of other things.
Four. By reminding you of a very powerful scene from a motion picture called The Fixer. Based on the novel by Menard Malamud, the hero, a Jewish handyman in Tsarist Russia about the turn of the century, has been imprisoned on some trumped-up charges. In this particular scene, the anti-Semitic warden, after having been totally disrespectful to the prisoner, asks him, "Tell me, Jew, do you know what the word respect means?" The prisoner thinks for a moment, then replies, "Yes, respect is what you have in order to get." This concept of mutual respect, as Dreiker's called it, is vitally important in modern parent-child relationships. But how well can we even recognize our own disrespectful behaviors and attitudes? Let's take a look.
"In a minute, huh?"
"I said, now, Dexter, now you get out there and wash those dishes."
If you have trouble recognizing mother's behavior as disrespectful, consider this next scene.
"Mom? Mom, I hear that letter that you said you had it for the day."
"In a minute, Dex."
"I said, now, Mom, you get out there and iron that shirt."
No doubt about it, is there now? Yet we adults do speak in ways that would be clearly disrespectful if used with other adults.
"Mr. Woodward, you've been over a few times and you've forgotten your umbrella twice. I don't know what's wrong with you. I swear if you didn't have your head screwed on, you'd forget that too. Now you're 43 years old. When are you going to start being responsible like your sister?"
In your action guide, you'll find a mutual respect exercise.
Listening has a few things to do with respect and how we feel encouraged about ourselves. Did a session on Wednesday that dealt a lot with encouragement, discouragement. We won't go as much into that, but we want to look at some specifics, some of the roadblocks that we use in communication and the effect it may have on us. When we deny another's feelings, the effect that may have on encouraging communication. When we don't really listen, or we assume that we know what the rest of the story is, and we begin to respond to that, or that we know what the right story is, and they're not telling it. I know better, even though I wasn't there. Any of you recall a situation back in your own schooling days, or someplace, even whether it was in work, where you come home to tell someone, whether it was your parent at that time or your partner or a friend at this time, about something that happened, and the first thing the person you're talking to says to you, "Well, what did you do to cause it all?" Or, "She's really not that bad. Why do you always put her down?" Or, "Well, why did you start the fight in the first place?" You know, without really hearing what we're saying, assuming that it must be my fault that it's happened. And if that's ever happened to you, what kind of response are you likely to give to the person who you're talking to? What would you do the next breath?
Defensive.
You get defensive. Okay. To be defensive is one response to. What's another response?
You just clam up.
You clam up.
Walk away.
You might walk away. Forget it. It's not worth You know, so you become defensive, you clam up, you walk away, none of which encourages further communication about the issue or good feelings about yourself. So we're going to look at some resources that you might relearn or learn some skills, not only for your parenting role, but also in your personal as well as professional communication. So let me go back to the tapes again.
Suddenly, one of the slaves began to drill a hole in the bottom of the boat, underneath his seat. "What do you think you're doing?" said the slave next to him. "What's it to you?" the first slave replied. "I'm only drilling the hole under my seat." Cooperation, the gentle art of working together for the common welfare, requires first and foremost that we recognize that we're all traveling in the same boat. And nowhere is this more true than in a family. When one family member experiences something, the ripples are felt by everyone. The first step in developing cooperation in a family is to establish a positive relationship between its members. Sounds easy, but it's often hard to do. Therefore, many of the skills you've been learning and will learn in this course focus on improving family relationships and fostering cooperation. To learn a little more about building positive relationships, let's turn to Dr. Poppy.
Building a positive relationship with children is a relatively new concept. In the past, when a superior-inferior relationship existed between parent and child, the burden of cooperation was clearly on the child's shoulders. How often can we remember our own parents saying, "How about a little more cooperation around here?" when what they really meant was, "Do what I tell you." In a society of equals, however, cooperation can no longer be demanded, it must be won.
And when there is cooperation, children feel that they're participating, that their feelings and opinions are being valued, which makes life easier for them, the parents, and the family. Jason, what's the matter?
Daddy, let me
hit you.
Yeah,
All right. Calm down. Now tell me what happened.
You hurt me. Then he pushed me down and you hurt my leg. See?
That is skin. I bet that hurts.
It does.
Jason, for heaven's sake, calm down. Will you please calm down? Now, you tell me, what did you do to make him hit you?
Nothing. I was just playing with my new truck.
Now, Jason, will you stop that crying? Big boys don't cry. Now, what are you going to do?
Do something I can do. He's bigger than me.
Jason, stop that and act like a big boy. Now, what you need to do is stand up for yourself. You need to show him he can't push you around.
How do you feel about that if you were Jason? What were some of the things that you caught there that if you were Jason, you would not feel so good about yourself?
You caused it in the first place.
It was my fault. What else?
Big boys don't cry.
And if you're crying, boy, you are a little baby, aren't you? What else?
Feeling of real inadequacy. Like what Dad says, I should have handled it this way. I didn't know how to handle it.
And then I should beat him up, but he's bigger than I am. Okay. Sometimes we may not know all the solutions for our kids. I think another important thing to remember as parents is that one of our important roles, we have a lot of them, is to help our children learn how to think, not just what to think. And when we keep telling them what they ought to be doing, we take away from them the opportunity to learn by their own experience what might be some other alternatives, what might be more helpful, what can I really do. Okay, we're going to get into some more roadblocks, because that's one of the things that's not that causes a lot of kids to tune us out, helps them to become more parent deaf than we would want them to be. Okay.
In the case of the conflict between Jason and Jenny, it's painfully obvious that the father failed to recognize that the problem is Jason's. So rather than supporting him, he actually made matters worse.
When a child, in this case Jason, has a problem, the job of the parent is to help the child think it through, help him or her recognize his or her feelings, and finally help the child do something about the problem. To do these three things requires an open line of communication. Unfortunately, as in this case, we as parents often do just the opposite and block communication before the child gets a solution. In fact, we recognize at least 9 examples of communication blocks.
And we'll show you what they are shortly. But before we do, let's discuss them.
Okay, what are some blocks of communication? What are some things that stop communication for you with other people, whether it's your own child or whether it's in other things? We might turn focus more specifically on child, but other illustrations are okay too. What are some of the things that just block communication for you?
Preoccupation.
The other person doesn't seem to be interested in what you're saying. They're looking all around, counting the flies going by, preoccupied with something else.
Being judgmental.
Boy, that's a stupid thing to say. You know, being judgmental and whatever, labeling or putting down the information the other person has. Anyone else? Those are the two most uncomfortable ones. What else?
Denying what they say.
That it couldn't possibly be true. What do you really know about this? Or denying feelings if that's really not what you feel. As if I know better what your feelings are.
Discounting. It's not really that bad.
Yeah, we do that a lot, don't we, with children? We discount, oh, it's not that bad. The scratch, it doesn't hurt that bad. Or it's, what she said isn't really that terrible. Okay, discounting what had happened. Anything else?
Not having a chance to talk.
Yes, just not even being able to start to even have someone discount you or not be attentive, that they're either not there or they're not interested, or they show through a variety of body language, forget it, don't try to get my ear, you won't get it. Okay, just not the opportunity to talk about it.
Always having a solution, whether it's real or not.
Okay, that anything you want to say, and most of the time when you want to tell someone about a concern that you have, is it to get a solution, or is it to sort of get it off your chest? And they may give you 5 very good solutions, and you may say what to each one of them?
Yes, but.
Yes, but, or no, try that, and, or it would be impossible. We have some negation for each one. At that time, sometime later, we might come back and look at them, but at that point, we're not ready to accept it. We just want to be heard. Kids, too. Anything else? Okay, we're going to look now at some roadblocks, and you might take the role of this. I think this is the next one up, is the young woman. Delightful young teenager.
Blocking communications with our children is a sure way to make problems worse. Not only aren't we helped, we actually add to the child's discouragement. There are at least 9 ways to block communication: by commanding, giving advice, placating, interrogating, distracting, psychologizing, being sarcastic, moralizing, and being a know-it-all. But those are just words and terms. Let's see what they look like.
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one will ask me.
Why don't you stop complaining?
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one will ask me. Oh, Lisa, you're so pretty. I'm sure someone will ask you. I don't have a date for the dance, and I know nobody will ask me.
Are you sure you're not worrying about this too soon?
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one's gonna ask me.
Hey, no problem. Let's not worry about that. Let's go out to lunch.
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one will ask me.
Very interesting. Why do you think no one has asked you?
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one's gonna ask me.
Oh, Lisa, you really shouldn't worry about that, dear. Life is just too short.
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one will ask me.
If I were you, I would be concerned about something that in the long run isn't very important.
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one's gonna ask me.
What you should do is ask one of the boys. How difficult is that?
I don't have a date for the dance, and I know no one will ask me.
I guess that's just about the end of the world.
How do you feel about that? Do you feel like talking any further?
Yeah.
Okay. We often do some of these roadblocks in our response to our kids, sometimes even with our friends, less likely with them, however, because we feel that that's our role. We ought to solve the problem. We ought to be judge, jury, and prosecuting attorney. We ought to be the know-it-all. We ought to be the analyst. We ought to be the whatever. That's our role, to be it all, and that they should just absorb it from us. But we've also learned that kids learn best by experience and by seeing a good model. So if we want them to learn how to think, we have to give them opportunity to think and to let them also experience a model that thinks it through and says, gee, now what can I do about this particular thing? One of the helpful things, however, in our beginning to encourage this communication is to be able to tune into feelings. The first section of this book is on acknowledging feelings, helping children deal with their feelings. And we're going to have just a little bit of video practice here. When we hear a child say something, what might they be feeling? And if you can identify what they're feeling, what would you say back for that first response, first or second response, before anything else happens, before you say any questions, before you give any advice? How can we help them to know that we hear them and that we understand what they're feeling? In the Parent Effectiveness Training Program, PET, we call this active listening. Here we're going to just talk about connecting feelings to content. It doesn't matter how you label it, but it's acknowledging the child's feelings, which in a sense says, hey, you're okay, even if you don't feel so good right now, or even if you do have a problem right now, you're still okay, to separate the problem from the child and their abilities. Okay, so we're going to go through these little sections, and I'll stop so that we can identify some of the feelings. There will be a variety of feelings for each situation, not just one. There's no right or wrong answer. But we're going to look at how we can identify the feeling and respond. And then you might also think, okay, if somebody responded to me in that way, how would I feel to identify the feelings? Okay.
I didn't make the team. I guess I just won't play this year.
What do you think he's feeling?
Disappointed.
Disappointed, discouraged, rejected. Okay, any one of those. How might you respond back to him to say, I hear what you're feeling and saying? One possibility might be, you were really looking forward to playing. That must be very discouraging. What's another? Someone else.
I know you tried hard to practice and didn't make the team. It must really hurt you to not make that team.
It must hurt to not make the team. Okay. Another possibility. How disappointing. You had your heart set on it. And if he says, no, I didn't really have my heart set on it, and that's okay if there's a correction or a clarification. Or confirmation, yeah, that's how I feel. Because then we know if we've gotten a wrong interpretation, they can help us get on the right track and we can be a little bit closer to them. Try again. Okay, let's look at another one.
Mom, Mom, I got the highest grade in the class on my Spanish test.
What's she feeling?
Excited, pride,
elated. Any others? There were several others. Okay, put any of those feelings into a statement back to her.
Wow, I can see you're really excited about that.
Great, another one.
Terrific.
What's terrific? What's she feeling?
She's feeling terrific.
Okay, then and we might say, boy, you really feel terrific about what you've accomplished. Earlier in the tape series, she has had a real problem with Spanish. So this is a follow-up. Okay, anything else? Another possibility, yes?
Could you say, hey, that's great, you can be proud of yourself.
Great, sure. We want her to be proud of herself. If we say, boy, I'm so proud of you, it's as if I really take responsibility for her studying that Spanish, and I'm taking ownership of pride. It's not a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good thing to say that, but it might be more helpful to say to her, you know, you sound proud of what work you've put in, of the effort you've put into it and the outcome. We want her to own the pride, because she's done the work.
But at the same time, you have to know that, let them know that you're proud of them. I had a friend whose father never told him that he was proud of him for all he'd accomplished, and it really hurt.
Mm-hmm.
He needed that.
Yeah, it depends upon whether we think we can feel proud of ourselves or not. Sometimes we've had the information that says, oh, pride goeth before a fall, so you're never supposed to be proud of yourself. Other people have to be proud of you. And I think it's more important to own the responsibility for your own feelings rather than letting other people own it for you. As I told the story in the earlier session, when our first daughter went into seventh grade, she came home with an outstanding report card, and her father said, Anna, we're so proud of you. And she looked at him with her big blue eyes and said, Dad, I was the one that did all the studying. I took the tests. I wrote the papers. I had to stand up in class and talk when I didn't want to. I walked to school all of those days. I can be proud of my accomplishments. You can be happy, excited, delighted, pleased with me. So ever since then, we have taken a note from her and have said, you must be very proud of yourself. We're delighted in what you've accomplished. Just another way of saying, we're proud of you, but we're letting her own the effort.
I was just going to say, I only give the right answer because I have been to one of your classes. Actually, I would have said, gee, that's great. I'm so proud of you. That's what I would have said.
Now you're realizing that you have some additional options and you can choose. And sometimes we might say, great, terrific, wonderful. But what's great, terrific, wonderful? Kids sometimes get overpowered. That's all you ever say. What do you really mean by? And so I tell parents, you know, if it's natural for you to say great, terrific, outstanding, fine. Don't put those words aside, but add something on. And say, you really worked hard for that. Or, that I like the way it looks. You've really learned some things in working through that project. That you add something more than just that makes it sound a little bit, that you've given some thought to it. It's not just a push an automatic button that says outstanding. Do you really mean it? Can't you think of anything else might go on in their mind? And when you fill in the blank afterwards, it gives them some of that information that can help them a little bit further. Okay, on to next.
I don't believe this. This room's a mess. I'm never going to get this clean.
Have you heard that before? Or you've had that feeling before? What do you think he's feeling?
Discouraged.
Overwhelmed.
Discouraged, overwhelmed.
Frustrated,
beaten before he even begins. Okay, use any of those statements and say something back to him. If that were your child, what would you really want to say first of all?
It's your own darn fault.
It's your own darn fault. Okay, if I said that to you, how would you feel about having to do the job?
Well,
Worse.
Worse. Okay, so if that's the response that you would have, what do you think your child would have? A different response? A more lofty one? Sure, that's going to energize me. I'll get right at it. No. So if it's not going to encourage you, let's not use it on our kids. What can we say that might tell them that we understand where they are without dealing anything with the past?
You can acknowledge, yeah, a lot of work to be done there. And maybe I'll talk to him again for a few minutes.
Okay. There's a lot of work to be done there. Would you like me to help you get started? That doesn't mean you have to finish it with him. Okay. The overwhelmed, discouraged, what's another statement we can say to him?
You don't really want to say, gee, you must be overwhelmed. That seems kind of silly.
Well, not necessarily. He at least says, yeah, somebody understands the situation I'm in. We might say instead, it sounds like you feel overwhelmed about all that needs to be done. We could then put the next step, wonder where it will be best to start. Not that we're going to tell them, but that we give them a little point at which they can begin thinking. You need to start somewhere. Does that help? Is that a little bit helpful? Does that still feel faking?
Yeah, that's a tough one.
I still think when a kid comes to keep cleaning his room, no matter what you say, they're going to fight it, and it's going to take all day, even though it's a 20-minute job.
Yeah, but only because they know that that can tie you in. They know that they can sometimes get away with it. They know that it's an automatic button that gets pushed on them, and when it pushes an automatic button on you, it's a game that they're playing with you. If you can dare to do something different and respond in a different way instead of saying, say, I told you, if you would have done it, and sort of, that just gets them even more discouraged, and they say, I don't want to do it, and it gives them more fuel for the fire. If we can say, boy, I'd be overwhelmed too if I had all this to do in one time.
I think also you got to realize that your kids might have a different standard than you. I am very neat, and my daughter is very creative when she isn't that neat. And we fought about her room, and one year I come to Holden, and I saw a card, and it says, let's see, prepare for eternity, clean your room. I stuck it in the room, and after that, I just kept the door shut, and she became failure. Still not, I like things, I mean, it's just, you know, how we all have our peculiarities.
And to also recognize that it's taken us X number of years to get to the point where we're tidy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And why do we want our children to assume that level at a much younger stage? Maybe we always were tidy, but people come with different personalities. And we can help them reach an acceptable level so that the health department doesn't come in and close us down. But to always be on the kid's back, I think, is just a challenge to say, you can't control me. In the early stage of years, kids win the battle of power and control by eating or not eating. When they're trying to be trained at two, then the power and control is holding back and not using the potty when you tell them to use the potty. And, you know, you could be there for 2 hours, and the minute, 2 minutes after you get them off the potty and give up, then they do it in their diaper. That's their beginning sense of having control. And when it becomes older, that room is that sense of control. And so one of the things we might do is another area to look at how can we allow them to have a certain sense of power so that they don't need to take it in places where it's not as helpful. That they can make some choices in other things. But that we just know that there are certain limits in the house, acceptable limits that need to be done, and it's an expectation. It's part of their responsibility as being part of the house. On the board, I have a number of words that we'll refer to in a little bit. But setting limits is certainly one, so that and that's done with children even as young as three. Below the age of three, you really are the limit setter, the problem solver. And giving attention, describing, encouraging, helping them to think. May not. Some of these at the bottom are not as easily done with the under three, but you can still do it as a model where you're working through it for them and they see it in action. The list on the other side are the ones that I think are not quite so helpful. pause only lasts certainly for time.
I don't want to go with you.
Okay, I don't want to go with you. You've heard that many times. What's the feeling? We identify what the feeling is. We can identify what our own feeling is, and that's of irritation, frustration, anger.
Loss of control.
Loss of power. And that's what we feel too as a parent. Anything else? He's determined, isn't he? Sometimes we want kids to be determined, but not in situations like that. But you might still identify and say, you're really determined not to have to do this, aren't you?
Aren't you reinforcing something? He has to go with it. That's the bottom line.
That's the bottom line, but it doesn't do any harm to say, I understand how you feel. But instead, but we need to define what it is that we think they feel. So if I were just to say, I understand how you feel, he would say, no, you don't. If I were to say, you're really determined about not having to go, then he can say, well, I'm not determined at all, it might be something else. Or he may just say, have silence, which probably means you're right, but I don't want to have to admit it.
But you know, I've tried that with my son, and it doesn't make any difference. He still will throw himself on the floor and say, I don't want to go.
How old?
And five.
Five.
So the bottom line is you pick him up and you put him in the car and you tell him.
Yeah, and you can still do that with acknowledging feelings. I can understand you don't really want to go. You're determined to be able to do what you right. want to do. This is one of those times when I can't really allow that choice. Sometimes you can have that choice. This is not the time. And you can still acknowledge your feelings even when you carry through on what you need to do. But instead of yelling and saying, why are you always so stubborn and obstinate? Why do you create so much problems? Why did I ever have you? What do you think that's doing to the kid? That's adding more insult to injury. There's enough insult to injury there of having to accept gracefully that you're going to do it with mom, whether you like it or not. You might as well do it so that they can maintain their own sense of self-esteem to say, at least she's heard me, she knows what I feel. And then, since she's being reasonable with me, I may still kick up my heels a little bit, but not as long as they might otherwise.
Well, and to me, too, it's a question of respect, because what was this child doing before you said, okay, it's time, we've got to go to the store right now. He's in the middle of building a tower, and you know, he has something else on his mind that's his agenda, and we're putting our agenda on him, and so possibly that's a real feeling of anger. I don't want to go because I want to do this, but all that child's feeling is angry.
And we don't feel that children ought to have some feelings. It's our feelings in response to them. They do, we do. We need to acknowledge both feelings. Mm-hmm. And with a five-year-old, we can do some problem solving ahead of time saying, I know you may not want to go to the store with me at this time because you still want to finish doing the such and such, whatever. But that's, I can't leave you alone. How else do you think we can solve this? So you might even bring five-year-olds beginning to go to school. Five-year-olds going to have to think through some problem situations and come up with a solution, because you're not with that five-year-old every minute from the time they leave the door or you leave them at the schoolyard until they come home again. We've got to teach them to think through some problem solving so we can help them. You know that this is going to be a disruptive situation, to think through it ahead of time. And maybe if there's enough goodwill in the bank, they'll say, okay, I'll go with you if I can do such and such later. Not that it's a bribing, but it's an understanding that I need some time to do something, you need some time to do something, let's negotiate that. I think that helps to build, show respect, which we had beginning. Yes?
It also gets back to setting limits. You know, all of a sudden, bringing on your point, a kid's in the middle of building a tower or reading a book, and you say, oh, time to drop that and do something else. And they feel powerless because all of a sudden somebody's intruding on their agenda by setting a limit. I found out with my nephews and nieces, you can say you give them some time. In a half an hour, it's time to go to bed. In 5 minutes, we will be doing something, and they can start thinking ahead to the limits that are set, and then thereby learn to get these limits across to themselves.
Doesn't come a total surprise.
Yeah, it's not a total surprise. I got a warning that there's going to be something incoming or something like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That they have this, they recognize they have some options, that you're allowing them some choices and you're recognizing their feelings. I think those are very basic to the whole process of building up communication parent-child, parent and another person. You probably aren't going to run into your friend's house and say, come on, we've got to run really right now, when you've probably been standing and talking for 5 or 10 minutes or doing something else with them, and then just pull them along by the hand if they start to resist, to say, I've got to get my coat, I've got to go to the bathroom first or something like this. We don't do this with adults, but we do do it with the kids. In a sense, showing them disrespect. I think respect goes two ways. And I think children learn respect from being respected, that very first story. You don't know how to respect someone else until you feel that you've been respected first, that you have respect. Yes?
Another thing, I'm going to the grocery store with my kids. I always had tasks for them in the grocery store. Now, they had, there were things that they could pick out that they wanted to, and cut their breakfast cereal, or they picked the apples out, or did something like that. So it became, not that I was going to the store, but we're going to go to the store, and we're going to find some things that we want.
That they can participate. It's not just being dragged along, but they have a responsibility. And in most of our homes today, we almost have to make responsibilities available to kids because they're not part of the natural order. I grew up on a farm, and my responsibility was to pick eggs in the morning and in the evening. And if I did it very quickly and just dropped them, that meant we didn't have a lot of money for food, because that the egg was our food money. And if I didn't, then they didn't candle out as the best grade eggs, and we got a lower price for them. Again, the money was less. So there was a direct need for everyone's participation. When everybody was out thrashing, I had to do the milking. And if the milk didn't get done, the cow might have gotten sick, or you didn't have the milk for the next meal, or to sell for cream. And again, the money was less. So in earlier days, there was direct relationship for your need and being a participant. That doesn't happen as much. Even now people say, well, we got a dishwasher so kids don't have to wash dishes. I still have a lot of cleanup to do, even though I have a dishwasher and that our kids did it. And it was a thing that we did together because that was one of the few times we could have to talk together. The two things that have ruined communication, the greatest between parent and child, is the advent of the TV and the advent of the dishwasher. Because kids used to have to do all those things in the kitchen. And now they think mom can do it, dad can do it. And they can run off because they've got a baseball game. They get so involved in this, that, or the other thing. And they don't have any responsibilities. I believe very much in kids having responsibility and taking tasks and getting a sense of their self-esteem from the I can do it. I am needed. If I'm not there, it doesn't get done. And it needs to get done. Yes?
Another thing I've really observed my three-year-old is that consistency and policy, both of which take time, but he really looks for, if I say we're leaving in 5 minutes today, we leave in 5 minutes, but I say we're leaving in 5 minutes tomorrow, when we don't, he's got me. I mean, he looks, consistency and follow through. I mean, really, the same thing. If dad says this, it means this. If dad says this, I mean, even if I'm consistent when I, the way I say it, well, that means dad doesn't really mean it. But every time he says it that way, he doesn't mean it, and every time he does, he does. So that,
it's confusing. Yeah. You need to, Barbara Culler also has done a marvelous tape, and if you want to use it in any resource area, I think you'll find people in your community who have heard of this. And it's just a tape on discipline, kids are worth it. And she has a little saying that says, say what you mean what you say, and do what you said you are going to do. How many of you have heard that tape on discipline? It's excellent. I use it, I loan it out to people in my classes because I think it's just basic. We can work further on it, but it gives them a chance to hear it and begin.
What's your name, Kathy?
Barbara Coloroso, color and O-S-O on the end, C-O-L-O-R-O-S-O. She's from Colorado.
And it's just called Discipline?
Discipline, kids are worth it. She's coming out with one this fall that includes for teenagers, because now her kids are teenagers.
Okay.
But that acknowledging of feelings before you launch in, and then maybe once you identify with the feelings, you aren't going to be quite so likely to launch into a lot of questions: who, what, why, when, how come. And in fact, you'll find that the question why is a very unhelpful one. Why, whenever somebody, you say something and somebody asks you why, don't you immediately feel a little bit on the defensive? Well, why should I have to, you know, document myself? There's a lot of other ways you can ask a question. Why'd you do that? Instead of what had you hoped would happen? What were you thinking about? What did you want to accomplish? And you might find out that they were on a very different wavelength. And I think when we tell kids, clean your room, we have a certain vision of what that clean room means. But kids don't have a plug-in to your head to recognize. I mean, you could say it to them dozens of times. But it's still your words until they began to recognize the need for it.
They also need to be taught from an early age the steps involved in cleaning a room, because often as adults we assume they know how to clean their room, now go do it, and they don't really know how to even begin, let alone.
This is one of my favorites. Whenever we use that word, that's what happens.
Yes.
We assume something, and we tend to make an ass out of you and me because we're on the wrong paths. And it might be more helpful to be clear, definitely clear about it. Now, what is it? And if you give a request, the section in here on encouraging cooperation, when you give a request, that you need to do it by going up and saying, what's your name? Vi. To Vi, I need you to help set the table in 5 minutes. Now, what is it that I need to have done? And when?
No. 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay, you've got it. I know that she's heard me. Most often we yell from the other side of the room, Vi, Vi, it's time to set the table, Vi. And then we go on and the table isn't set. We come back in and say, Vi, why are you so irresponsible? I told you to set that table. Now get in there right now and set it. And she'll say, what? I didn't hear you. Yeah, we don't know. And kids will recognize if there's a room apart, and if you don't see them, they have a lot of excuses to say, I didn't know what you had to say. I didn't hear you. But if we can get, it may get, we all can use a little bit more exercise. We all eat a little bit more than we need to. So to go those extra steps and make sure that you have their attention, touching them on the shoulder, and wouldn't shake them. I mean, that's disrespectful. You wouldn't do that to your friend. Eye-to-eye contact, and maybe even down to where I can see their eye, if they're down little. And then the checking back. What is it that I need, and when? We often forget about the when part. And we expect them to intuitively know when I need it done. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it may not be. But even if it is obvious, it's helpful to have it confirmed.
But it's also selective listening, because you can say, you know, set the table. But if you whisper from the other room, there's some cookies and milk on the table. They're there.
Sure.
So they're not none of this stuff, I didn't hear you. It's just a matter of what they want to listen to.
Yeah, there was a marvelous little For Better For Worse cartoon in the paper just a couple of days, in the last week or so. I wish it was at some friend's house so I couldn't tear it out. But Michael was being told something, and he didn't do it, and somebody said, Michael, one of his friends said, Michael, didn't your mother tell you to do such and such? And he said, yeah, but I unlistened. Well, some of the things that we might do to help help kids, some of the things we might do to listen so kids will talk and to talk so kids will listen, and they both go together, is that when a child comes to talk to us, to give them their full attention. It may take 30 seconds. We should be able to find 30 seconds. If the telephone rings, we probably can spend 5 minutes on the telephone, not really knowing who it's going to be ahead of time, but we'll manage. Our kid comes in and wants a minute or two, don't have enough time. Who's important? And that telephone call may be telemarketing something or other, talking about rug shampooing, and you're wondering what the gimmick is, so you'll listen for a couple of minutes and then end up saying no thank you. Who's more important?
How do you deal with interruptions?
What age?
5, 6.
Oh, when they're 5 or 6, I think you can begin to set some limits, and they can begin to learn some levels of patience, but it's not something you can teach them right when you're on that telephone. Something you're going to have to work at when you're in what we call a no-problem area. You've got some pleasant time, and you're saying, hey, you know, I remember this morning when I was doing such and such, and you were in such and you had to have my attention, and when I finally gave it to you, you forgot what it was. And I wonder what we can do to solve this problem. You're combining several important things. You're showing respect that they're not just the problem. You both own a problem together. You're giving them an opportunity to think, to have some experiences at thinking through and coming up with some possibilities, and encouraging them to participate in sharing responsibility, and that we can learn instead of just being labeled and always demanding, that it's a cooperative venture, this life we live together. They can't demand the teacher's attention every time they want it when they're in class and there's 30 other kids. So we have to begin to teach them something of that at home, and you can begin at age 3 and 4.
Don't you feel too that if you resist and don't give them your attention often enough, then they start interrupting more and more because it is a ploy for your attention?
If they can't get it your attention in positive ways, they know they can get it negatively, and that's what they'll do what works. Some of the particular skills out of how to talk to kids who listen include this tuning into feelings, identifying feelings, recognizing feelings, whether it's with a word or with a statement, giving that full attention instead of half listening, instead of always asking questions or giving advice, to just acknowledge with a word. My favorite story is little Johnny who runs inside the house all out of breath, and he says, "Mommy, Mommy, where did I come from?" And she thought, fine, the kid was 6 or so. She said, finally, he's asking, I better give him some information about the birds and the bees. So she launches all into this whole thing about how babies are made and so forth. And when she finally catches a breath, he stops and says, "Was I born in Toronto or was I born in Ottawa?" Johnny was. You know, somebody else says. So we need to listen long enough so we know what their question is. Where did I come from? So we might, I call them friendly grunts. Sometimes we might just listen with a, oh, mm-hmm, yeah, wow, depending upon what's appropriate to that situation. Then to acknowledge on occasion in between those friendly grunts what you think they're feeling. Check out if what you're hearing is what they really want you to hear. You're really upset that you can't play softball with your friends this afternoon because we have a dentist appointment. You're really discouraged. We'll have to figure out how we can make these arrangements other times, or we're going at such and such a time, will there be enough time afterwards? So that we really listen to them and let them know that we respect their needs as well as our needs. Sometimes it's allowing the child's wishes and fantasy, which you can't allow in reality, to allow in fantasy. One father talked about his 6-year-old daughter hated to go to the grocery store. Mom always took so much time. This time Mom was busy and he had to go to the grocery store in the evening because they just didn't have what they needed for breakfast, and she was fussy and fuming, too young to stay alone. And finally he said, "You really wish we could have the grocery store right here in our own basement and we didn't have to run down the street and do da da." And she stopped fussing a bit, and she said, "Yeah, we could have the milk over there." And they began talking about this. She got her jacket on. They went to the grocery store. They still talked about where they could put what aisles in their basement, came back, and they were laughing and had a good time. He said, "I never thought it would ever work. When you said that in the class, I thought, boy, that's one thing that won't work with my kid." But it's recognizing that they have wishes, too. It may not always be realistic to do at this particular time, but you can acknowledge them. One of the most handy-dandy words, giving attention, naming the feelings, is to describe. It's free, it's non-caloric, it has no cholesterol, it's inexpensive. But to describe what you see. I see a room that needs cleaning, or I see a room that has its bed already made, and the dirty clothes are in the laundry basket. Maybe there's still a lot of toys and other things out there, but at least acknowledge what you see that's positive. See the glass half full instead of half empty all the time. And then you can follow it up to say, well, what do you think still needs to be done? Rather than saying, how come you haven't? Just discouraging. And then they feel, nothing I do is ever right. Nothing can meet your needs. Describe what you see. Describe what you feel. I'm delighted that you've gotten such a good start in your room. It's difficult when you've got so much to do. Describe your expectations. I really expect the room to be kept so that the health department doesn't come in to close us down, so that the rodents don't come in and I don't find half of my dishes up under your bed when we're looking for them. How do you suppose we can solve this problem? Invite them in to be part of the solution, not just the problem. Describing is very helpful. It eliminates the blaming. Instead of saying, you shouldn't, you should, it's saying what needs to be done, what you feel, what you see, what you expect. I think one of the most important things in how to talk so kids will listen and listen so kids will talk is the whole idea of giving lectures. Remember one of my daughters saying a number of years ago, telling about a new boyfriend, he likes to tell long stories, Mom. You'll like him. I did. But I used more words than I needed to. That was one of my difficulties that I really had to cut down and not give lectures. And I try to do it with just words. Sometimes I just wrote a note, kept my words out of it completely, and that worked great. You can give positive responses to them to say what you liked, what you appreciate, what you're grateful for, and that will stay with them. That will get more things done than all the criticism that we can give them for why didn't you, how come you don't ever, and don't you know how to do it after all this time? When we emphasize something positively, we underline it and score it, underscore it, and they say, yeah, I can do it. I'm okay. Lectures, if you can reduce it to from a page to a paragraph, fine. If you can reduce it from a paragraph to a sentence, great. If you can reduce it from a sentence to a word, you've got it made. And you'll have kids who just will be less likely to be parent deaf, to tune you out, to unlisten. Instead of labeling, we often label kids. You're the slow one, you're the fast one, you're my goody two shoes. And then all the rest of the siblings hate her or him. Comparing one child we think is motivating, but it's actually demotivating. Anything you have to say to a child can be said to that child directly without comparing them to another. That's probably the hardest thing. We always think that they ought to learn from someone else. But that's not exactly the way it works. They'll see that other person in modeling, but we don't have to always put them up as the guideline because they may be at a level that's unreachable by the younger one. And then we wonder, why is the 10-year-old tuned out because they can't always do what the 15-year-old is doing? Well, there's a great difference. And those, what you allow a 15-year-old to do and what you'd allow a 10-year-old, as well as the ability level. So we need to look at them in their each separate stand at their position. Instead of ordering to problem solve, to listen to what they see as part of the problem, what their needs are, to let them know what your needs are and say, well, what are some possibilities? To offer some choices, to let them bring up some choices, to evaluate what you can accept, what you can't accept, what they can accept, cannot accept. Figure out what might work for you, what you're both willing to try. And then that important point of how are we going to put it into action? What's your responsibility, what's mine, and by when? How, maybe even? How should we go about doing it? What do you expect? What do I expect? And then checking back at a later time. That whole issue of problem solving, to involve them with their ideas and their needs, that that you can work together on it rather than top down all the time. You do this, and it better be done by, or else. And if they've got any amount of spunk in them, they're going to say, well, what's the or else? Just, will you really follow through? And half the time we don't. We may think we follow through all the time. Maybe it's even more than half the time we say, forget about it. It's just too much bother to go through. I'll do it myself. And we do this at a very young age so that when kids start temper tantrums at 1.5 or 2, and they continue, I can remember really about 3 temper tantrums that our older daughter did. I can remember about 2 that our second daughter did, and until they finally realized, hey, this didn't work. And I learned some things in between the two. One, that it's okay to walk out if they're not really in a space that they can hurt themselves. Or if it's a real sad situation, it may be helpful to just stay by them, to touch them, to rub their back, to rub their foot, which helps to relax them, and say it's going to be okay. When you're all finished, we can talk about it. Sometimes walking out makes them even more defined. They think they're being abandoned, and that's scary for a little kid. But sometimes that's what you have to do. Last week, one mom was wanting the child to go up the hill with her, and the little 2-3-year-old just wasn't going to, so she just flopped down on the sidewalk. Mom continued up the hill. I started to walk just to distract the child, and another staff person came by and chatted to her, so I walked away, sat down to do something else. Next thing I looked around, there was my husband lying flat on his stomach on the ground, exactly like she was, with his head by hers, just talking to her. She looked at him, she quieted down a little bit more, and she got up and toddled up the hill. I didn't have my camera with me at the time. I wish I had. Sometimes they just need to be distracted. And they'll think, this is too ridiculous. I'll go on to where life is real. We need to allow children an opportunity to think for themselves and to process. Boy, this is really a mess. I wonder what can be done about it. This didn't work out the way you wanted. What can you do about it?